Good evening and welcome back to Coast AM. We're talking about a very strange story, the Stephen Avery case, which was covered on the Netflix documentary series, Making a Murderer. And I know I've sounded passionate and sometimes frustrated during this interview. Understand it's not with Michael Griesbach. It's in a system that failed a man the first time, and how the system was called into account the second time for a crime that he very well may have committed, but yet they still made heinous mistakes in many different ways and many different angles, and so many people seeming incompetent at the job that they were doing. That's the frustration level I feel, as I'm sure many listeners have that have watched the series, and wanting to get some kind of answer, make some kind of sense of the things that we've seen. And why? Because it's terrifying. Murder is terrifying. Being put in prison for your life, for the rest of your life, for a crime you did not commit once is terrifying. A second time, unbelievable. The Netflix series does a really amazing job at painting a picture of a man that's been railroaded into jail, giving us pieces and perspectives of the story. And they've put together a very compelling narrative that leads you to believe Stephen Avery is innocent. Now, there's a different side of the story, as Michael Griesbach has been talking about and as he covers in his book. Joining us in the next segment on the show with Michael Griesbach is Dan O'Donnell. And he does a really fascinating podcast, Rebutting a Murderer. And he has taken this upon himself to go episode by episode, systematically dismantling the series' vague allegations of a conspiracy by the Manitowoc County Sheriff's Department to frame Stephen Avery. So over the course of 10 episodes, he rebuts each one of Making a Murderer's claims and outlines the evidence that the show omitted, evidence that he believes proves once and for all that Stephen Avery and his nephew, Brendan Dassey, raped and killed Teresa Halbach. We'll talk with him. We'll talk with Michael Griesbach. We'll do that next right here on Coast to Coast AM. Michael Griesbach is one of my guests this evening. He's a prosecuting attorney in the Wisconsin County where the events of the Stephen Avery case took place. And he has written the book, The Innocent Killer, talks about this case from all angles. Joining us also, Dan O'Donnell, who's a journalist, and he reveals a smoking gun piece of evidence that convinces him that Making a Murderer subject Stephen Avery is guilty in his podcast series, Rebutting a Murderer. Dan, thank you for joining us here this evening as well.
Well, it's certainly my pleasure, Dave. Thank you for having me.
I'll tell you, you know, I'll be the impassioned voice of the audience that watched the Netflix series and thinks that there's been a miscarriage of justice involved in the second part of the story. And I'd love for you and Michael to do what you do and play your side of this hand, because I've listened to your Rebutting a Murderer podcast, and I really am fascinated by it. Some of the stuff you make me stop and scratch my head and rethink. Some of them I'm screaming at the radio going, Dan, what are you seeing I'm not seeing? That's ridiculous. and it's driving me mad. And I'm fascinated to talk to you about these aspects. So I agree, or I'm thankful you agreed to come on and do this with us this evening. I asked Michael in the last segment, you know, what were some of the things he thought were glaring issues? One of them being the Brendan Dassey confession and things like that. What do you make of the confession, and what are you privy to that maybe the rest of us in the Netflix universe don't know about that confession?
Well, I don't think there's anything that I'm necessarily privy to. However, I dare say I am one of the few masochists who actually sat and watched all 4 hours of Dassey's confession on March 1st, 2006 that was at issue. The issue, of course, is that said confession was supposedly coerced. Now, coercion, as it's commonly defined, is getting someone to do something against their will through either the use of force or a threat. And in those 4 hours, there is, I don't believe, anything that could be considered under the standard definition coercive. Yes, the law enforcement officers interrogate him for a very, very long time. Yes, they say, we know you're lying, Brendan. Just tell us the truth. Tell us the truth, Brendan. That's a lie, Brendan. Tell us the truth. I don't believe, though, that that rises to the level of coercion. I know I disagree with both Michael and you, Dave, on that score, because what I see in that confession is a kid trying his hardest, trying his very hardest to come up with a lie, to come up with something that will allow him to get away with this. Ultimately, though, the forensic evidence that the investigators do have leads them to the conclusion that he knows more than he's telling. Finally, he cracks. Finally, he says in painstaking, amazing detail that is corroborated by physical evidence, step by step, what happens. Now, on the witness stand, the prosecutors ask him, Brendan, how could you go into this much detail? How could you know this much if you were lying? His response was, I might have read about this in a book. And the prosecutors are puzzled. They say, what book? He says, Kiss the Girls. And he doesn't remember. It's by, I believe, James Patterson. He says, I read it in Kiss the Girls. That's a 464-page book. It's very densely written. He reads at a fourth grade level. That right there, to me, indicates that there was no real way he could have come up with this on the spot and give details that match so perfectly unless he was recalling those details.
With that said, Dan, have you looked in the book Kiss the Girls? And is there or are there accounts that match similar to what the story was Brendan Dassey gave?
I mean, it's similar, but we're talking about someone who supposedly has very low cognitive function. Mm-hmm. Being able to take a scene from a book, which, remember, was written far above his grade level in reading. And if he has cognitive disabilities, if he has a learning disability, that would likely include a difficulty retaining information that he read. It would have to be believed that he was not only able to retain that information, but to use it and essentially change the characters, make the bad guy his uncle, and use that information that he's retained, that he remembers, in a completely new story that he invents. Now, that story matches up perfectly with a lot of the details. Most notably, the one that stuck out in my mind was where he said, what did we do with the vehicle? What did you guys do with the vehicle? He says, we took it up by this little ridge, and then we covered it with branches and with the hood. Well, that's exactly where the volunteer searcher found the RAV4. I mean, that's a detail that obviously isn't in Kiss the Girls, but it's a detail that he remembered, and it's a detail that
he... But is it a detail? Is it a detail he heard on the news? We found the car under branches with a hood pressed against it.
Right.
Because that's part of it. Now, the other thing I'd bring up to you, Dan, is the fact when I was a young boy, my best friend Rick's sister used to read romance novels, some dirty romance novels. And my friend Rick would highlight certain sections, and I would read those bits, and those stuck in my mind. And I'm going to tell you the truth, that if there was something exciting and enticing and alluring about that segment, it may be ingrained, and especially if he read it more than once. And just because some people are at a lower level of functionality, with their skill sets, doesn't mean that they're not proficient in other aspects. And visualization is a very strong aspect that many of us can relate to. So he may not have been able to read and grasp the concepts of the entire book, but if there were a few dirty and raunchy parts and sexually aggressive parts, those would stand out. And maybe to an innocent like that, who is not used to that in his world, don't you think that there's something that could be said for that aspect?
Right, but I just question how police officers would be able to be so coercive that he confesses to something he read in a book. I mean, obviously the kid is not the brightest bulb in the display, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
But in there was nothing that I got from the interrogation, and I would highlight the hour and 45-minute mark until about the 2-hour and 20-minute mark, and you can find this on YouTube, the Brendan Dassey confession full, where he's giving intimate details, and he's saying the narrative himself. There aren't the investigators saying, Brendan, you found that vehicle, or you put that vehicle with the branches over it and the hood over it. Where did you put it? He's giving these details unprompted and unprovoked. He's giving very incriminating details, unprompted and unprovoked, at every step of the way for a good hour here. So,
right, but his family is also under the gun, and his family is being accused of this crime, and it's on every news outlet and every radio station in the town. So he would be privy to hearing those stories and recounting what he's heard already, because it wasn't like that. That was
saying things, though. He's also saying things that nobody was privy to, particularly that the murder took place in the garage. Lo and behold, there are spent shell casings in the garage. There's, of course, the bullet fragment that was found. And the reason that it was found in the garage so late, and this is a big point of contention in the show, that the bullet fragment is only found after a number of searches of the area, was because the details that he provided, namely that the murder actually took place in this garage, made investigators say, okay, we have to go back to this, and we really have to focus on the garage. Remember, this was a 40-acre property, and they had no idea where on those 40 acres, if at all, this homicide took place. Okay, so Dassey gives this detail that no one, not investigators, not prosecutors who were given these news conferences, were privy to, and lo and behold, a bullet that matches Stephen Avery's gun with Teresa Halbach's DNA on it turns up in that garage.
And Michael, from your perspective, is that a little too convenient that it takes place after this and after multiple searches and the story is now told, but yet we still can't find blood splatter, we can't find any fragmentation of bone from the skull in this place, we can't find anything else that would prove it, that this murder took place in this garage?
When I have been, the best place to start out with pointing out how the Netflix documentary was an agenda-driven, sort of one-sided account in favor of suggesting that Avery was innocent and the police set him up, I never start with Brendan Dassey's confession because it's a two-edged sword, Dan. The argument that Dave is now making is, look, yeah, the police didn't see anything in the garage until they knew that that's what Brendan Dassey said, and lo and behold, a magic bullet, as one of the defense attorneys termed it at trial, shows up. It plays into the narrative of evidence planning. I don't go anywhere near Dassey's confession to show that the Netflix documentary is a bunch of nonsense. Not because I don't believe his confession is not true, but because there's so much else. Look, I'm sure we'll get to it, but I think it might serve the audience real quick, Dave, if you don't mind. They left out the fact that Stephen Avery misidentified himself as a woman when he asked Teresa Halbach to show up. They said that the incident before the incident in 1985 when he rammed his pickup truck into a woman's car and held her at gunpoint was nothing more than him being upset because she was spreading rumors. Never mind the truth, which I outlined in my book, which is this. He had been watching her with binoculars for weeks down the road as she got into her vehicle early in the morning. He had been sexually gratifying himself as she drove by his residence. He only let her go because she begged him to, because her child was in the back seat, her infant child. And this is one time where it's true. It was colder than hell in Wisconsin, like Netflix always seems to say the documentary. It was 10 below, and it was cold, and he let her go because of that. He pled, by the way, guilty or no contest to that charge, charges in association with that incident. And six of the 18 years he served in prison, he would have served anyhow. It was concurrent time for that offense. You know, listen to Netflix have it in their unyielding sympathy for Mr. Avery. That was kind of understandable on his part because she was spreading rumors. I mean, that right there tells you volumes, excuse me, about where they're coming from, as does passing off the cat burning incident when he doused a cat with gasoline and intentionally threw it in the fire. By the way, he pled to that, too, and when he was 22. This wasn't a childhood prank where he was horsing around with friends and the cat accidentally ended up in there. And this is a pretty one-sided, I think there's some real questions. I wouldn't call this journalism, and I don't know where you draw the line. But this was a manipulation of a huge amount of people who watched this. And it affects the court system. You know, I guess that's where it gets to me. We need to decide these things in a court of law with rules of evidence.
Right, without the preponderance of evidence that's brought in by the media and speculation and looking to fill newscasts, right? And bringing about all this could possibly be false evidence that ends up playing a big part in the case later. I've got a few minutes left in the segment. I have a quick question for you, though. Some want us to believe Avery's much smarter than he comes off. Some believe that he was smart enough to lay down sheets and do this murder and then get rid of the sheets. If he was smart enough to do all that and not leave fingerprints in the car, how is he dumb enough to leave a blood print in multiple locations? Why wouldn't he take and compact or crush the car? And with a smelter on site, why not burn her body there where it's going to be burned to dust instead of throwing her into a fire pit with it? Now, trust me, on that angle, I don't know how you get around the fact that there's a fire in your backyard and there's a dead body roasting on it and you're not aware of that. I don't know how that could possibly be. That's beyond my comprehension level. But maybe, Dan, start with you in those aspects I brought up. How do you make sense of that?
How do I make sense of the evidence that was omitted? I'm sorry, what aspect?
Well, okay, there's no fingerprints in the car, but he was dumb enough to leave blood smears. There was a compactor on site. He didn't crush and compact the truck. He just took it out and left it out there to be found. And he could have burned her body to ash in the smelter, but he didn't do that.
Well, okay, here we're presuming that he would think like you or I would think when he's not sure how quickly he has before the cops show up on the property. Okay, so we can say, all right, for the car crusher, why didn't he use that? Yeah, you or I would think about that. But you also make a great deal in this documentary series that he has a 70 IQ, so maybe he doesn't reason that far ahead and thinks instead that if I hide the car amongst the hundreds and hundreds of other cars and make it look like just another old junker, nobody will ever find it because I've hidden it so well. I mean, that's not even entertained as a possibility. As for the fact that there weren't fingerprints found in the car, we also presume that there are going to be fingerprints everywhere on everything that we touch, when in reality, we think that DNA evidence and forensic evidence just automatically appears, when in reality, it's a very good science, but it's an inexact science. It's entirely possible that I could touch something, and just a few hours later, given the right conditions, my fingerprint simply won't be there. That is a possibility, but again, a possibility that's never presented. I thought that was actually very interesting, that the defense didn't really go after this angle at trial. Like, say, by presenting a blood spatter analyst, a blood spatter expert, okay, who would say, look, it would be impossible for Avery to shoot this woman in the garage and not have high velocity spatter. That's something that one of the defense attorneys, I believe Mr. Buting, made a very big point of saying, that there would be high velocity spatter. When from a .22 caliber rifle, that's not necessarily true. There might not have been as much blood as we presume there to be. As for the fingerprints, it's entirely possible that there were prints there. They were not complete. It doesn't, as Mr. Buting suggests in the series, mean that because there were no Avery fingerprints found in the car, he necessarily was wearing gloves, and therefore he couldn't have bled on the car. Well, we have a concession that, yes, Mr. Avery did in fact have a cut on his finger, which he could be bleeding from, and it's a false presumption to simply assume that because there was no fingerprint evidence found, there couldn't possibly have been blood left in that car. And it was left in, what, six different places? And this was a big piece of evidence that was left out. There was DNA evidence under the hood latch of Teresa Halbach's car from Stephen Avery that is not believed to be from blood evidence. It's believed to be from touch DNA or possibly from his sweat. And once again, this is something that matches up with Bassey's confession. Think what you want about that. It's another piece of evidence. He says his uncle goes under the hood of the car. I believe it was to disconnect a battery cable. So the fact, I guess there's sort of an old saying in the law, and that is absence of evidence does not indicate evidence of absence.
Rebutting a Murderer. We'll be back with more Coast to Coast AM right after this. Our guests this evening are discussing the Stephen Avery case, the murder case that was featured in the Netflix series Making a Murderer. Let me ask Michael Griesbach real quickly. I brought up the fact of having the car crusher, the smelter on site, and according to Dan, he said, well, you know, he's not thinking logically like us. In most cases, I would agree, but in this fact, this is the life Stephen knew. He knows car destruction. He knows crushing and burning and hiding. Does it seem strange to you that the car would be left out and that her body would have just been burned in a fire pit and not gotten rid of in a, you know, especially if he is worried about the cop showing up quick, throwing it in a burning pit with a bunch of tires doesn't seem like the fastest, most efficient way to get rid of a body.
Avery was fact smart. I think he knew exactly what he was doing. And the next thing he was on the list was to put the car in the car crusher. He did everything he could. Remember, he was going up north. Maybe some of his family was coming there. And the fear of the police at the time, and thank goodness this did not happen, because had Stephen Avery gotten around to getting that car in the crusher, which was the next thing on the list, like I said, I don't think there would have been enough for a search warrant. The car wouldn't have been there. The police never would have got on the scene. The police never would have found the blood in the car or the key in the camper. I think Stephen Avery is much smarter than we think. And this IQ nonsense about Brendan Dassey, or that the person, the prior attorney, said he had a 70 IQ. I dealt with Stephen Avery. Stephen Avery is a complicated person, but he's a manipulative person, too. He testified in Jody Stokowski's drunk driving fifth offense trial that I had in between. That's his girlfriend that recently, by the way, said that he threatened her and did threaten her and beat her. In between his release from prison and his arrest for Teresa Halbach's murder, he testified and perjured himself and said he was the driver of the car. The jury didn't buy it. But he manipulated that, tried to manipulate that, and that's why Ms. Stokowski was in jail. But the point I'm making is he knows exactly, as a criminal defendant, how to hide his tracks. And he was doing a pretty good job, but he didn't get around to the car, which clearly, maybe he didn't know how to operate the crusher. I have no idea. Or maybe people showed up at home. But the fact is, he, real quick, Dave, because I know we only have so much time. Two things were left out of the documentary, and they weren't admissible at trial either. They could have been. It's a close call to whether Judge Willis should have let these things in. But in a documentary, they should have been mentioned if we're at all going to be even close to objective, and they are this. Number one, Stephen Avery told fellow inmates while in prison that he couldn't wait to get out because he wanted to torture women and kill them. He was even drawing sketches of a torture chamber, apparently. Now, that, to me, should have been, or could arguably, depending on the discretion of the judge, admissible in trial. Because, after all, this is what happened. He tortured and killed a woman. Now, the judge has to weigh those sorts of things. And that would be extremely, obviously, prejudicial in the sense that once a jury hears that, they're going to convict, aren't they? And we can't tie that, or the prosecutors at the time couldn't tie it directly to Teresa's murder. So the judge made a judgment call. The other thing they left out was that he bought leg irons and handcuffs within a few days or a week before this. Now, they weren't the same leg irons and handcuffs he used in murdering Teresa Halbach, but the fact that he's getting this stuff, again, prejudicial, you know, he claimed it was just whatever. Apparently, Jody Stokowski and him, strange sex toys, whatever you want to say. But those two facts, especially the first one, it seems to me, are damning evidence that Stephen Avery, in addition to all the physical evidence, aside from Brendan Dassey's confession, the key, the blood, the bullet, his calling her out there. I mean, this would have been a slam dunk prosecution case. I would have loved this case if it weren't for the opportunity to claim evidence planting, to cry out foul by the defense attorneys because of the injustice that occurred 20 years earlier.
Don't you think? I was going to mention real quickly, there's a crime that a gentleman just got off on, the thought crime they were talking about, the fact that this guy was going onto websites talking about killing and eating his wife, and how he and his online buddies would go about killing, filleting, and eating these people. And it broke. She found all this information. It went out. He lost his job. His whole life was upturned. Now they're if I remember correctly, over just the last few weeks, have released him and said they can't go forward with a case on something somebody talked about and thought about, but did not necessarily put into play. Just because it was something that was discussed in prison does not mean that that in fact should be admissible, I would think, because something that was talked about as a possibility and something that may or may not happen in the future, it's impossible to tie those two things together.
Well, thought crimes, I mean, it's crazy that he was even charged, obviously.
Right.
You know, you can't. But this is different. This is somebody who thought about that and talked about that and then did it. So he couldn't be charged with thinking anything. Let's hope we never get to that point, right, in this
right.
country or anywhere else.
We need to take another break in a second here. I'll let you wrap up with your thought, and then we'll take a break and come back.
I was just going to say that's a different question, and certainly its relevance if someone then does it in terms of that trial is a different question. I think it certainly is relevant to what folks should look at in determining whether they think he did it.
Let's take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll talk to Dan. I know one of the pieces of evidence he finds most damning is the key. Let's talk about the key. That's also a part that so many people find such a hard piece of evidence to swallow. We'll talk about that next on Coast to Coast AM. Dan O'Donnell, let's talk about rebutting a murderer. Am I understanding properly? You believe one of the biggest key pieces of evidence tying Stephen Avery to the case is the key that was found, her key found in his room on the seventh inspection of that room. Is that right?
No, I don't think actually that was a key piece of evidence. It was certainly a big piece of evidence, and it tended to show that he was the one who hid the car on the property. But the biggest pieces of evidence to me were the bullet, were his blood all over her car. And yes, there was touch or possibly sweat DNA on that key, which definitely did tie him to the car. But remember, his DNA is in, what, 6-7 different spots in and on that RAV4. So the key was a part of the puzzle. But as Michael Griesbach did a fantastic job of showing, there were so many pieces of evidence that the key wasn't the key. It was just more of a part of the puzzle.
Here's a quick question from one of the audience members who wrote in, and I thought this was fascinating, kind of a take on it. I think his name is John that wrote this in. He said, it looks like someone took a lot of care to hide the vehicle on the Avery property, moving things against it. Was there any DNA or fingerprints found on the items that were used to try to hide the vehicle?
No, but I would find it very difficult that there would be fingerprint evidence that would be on a branch. Certainly maybe like a hood would be possible, but again, just because there wasn't DNA or wasn't fingerprint evidence found there doesn't mean that the defendant didn't in fact touch the car.
But Michael, if there's blood inside the car, Stephen gets out, puts the hood against there, moves branches and logs and things like that, wouldn't there have been transference DNA of blood if he left it all over in the car? It only seems like it would be left behind on the items that were touched to put in front of and to hide the car.
No, I think Dan makes a good point. We call it the bogeyman, the fingerprint bogeyman. There's often, you know, jurors expect physical evidence, always. They expect DNA because of CSI and different shows like that. Oftentimes, there are no fingerprints. They're hard to lift unless they're really good prints. DNA is not everywhere. So the lack of evidence, I think that quote you had earlier, Dan, is right on. We can make too much of that. You know, it's not everywhere, not in every case.
Do we find in any of these pieces of evidence that were put out there, Dan, that you do look at it and you think, now that I don't have an explanation for? That is really weird.
To be perfectly honest with you, and I don't want to sound arrogant at all, but no, I don't believe there was anything that was presented either by the defense or by Making a Murderer, and they were one and the same. Let's not kid ourselves. The series did not find anything that the defense attorneys missed. In fact, you could make the case that the filmmakers did an even better job than Dean Strang and Jerome Buting in raising the defense's case, because obviously now millions of people think Stephen Avery is guilty, and obviously the 12 people who mattered, the ones who were on the jury, Stephen Avery's innocent, obviously those 12 people did believe that he was guilty. So, no, I don't believe there was, because the claims are made based on not actual evidence of any sort of conspiracy, but they provide opportunity and motive for the Manitowoc Sheriff's Department to want to plant evidence, to be in a position where they could plant evidence, but without the actual affirmative evidence that they did plant the evidence, I don't believe that it casts reasonable doubt to infer that a conspiracy exists without the actual proof that it's there. Remember, reasonable doubt is not any doubt. I believe it's unreasonable to assume that there was a conspiracy and there was evidence planting unless you can show definitively that, yes, a vial of Stephen Avery's blood was definitively used to plant that blood at the crime scene. Unless you can show that absolutely, I just don't see that the documentary or the defense really sealed the deal in showing that there was, in fact, a conspiracy to frame Stephen Avery.
But, Michael, with that said, there was a conspiracy to frame Stephen Avery in his first crime. Many of those people were involved, even though they were told not to be, they were involved and deeply involved in the second investigation. Doesn't that automatically, again, if we're going to look at Stephen Avery's past and we're going to take into account the crimes against humanity he's done in the past, should we not be taking into account much more the crimes that these police officers and law enforcement officers, judges, attorneys, whatever was involved in this, that they had involved themselves with the first crime?
Well, they were allowed to make that defense, and they should have been allowed to make that defense, absolutely, because of what happened last time. However, the Netflix documentary, again, misrepresented things. Link and Colburn were not actually parties to that lawsuit. They weren't sued personally. They were witnesses because of the call they took 10 years earlier from the jail in Green Bay. And they were accused of hiding evidence that when the other person supposedly said and did say that that Manitowoc has people in jail for a crime he did. Link and Colburn were only new officers. One was a corrections officer and one was a deputy at that time. They sent the word up the chain of command. And this is probably a little complicated for your audience members who might not know the whole story, but basically they did what they should. They said, hey, Sheriff, there's somebody else saying that they did this crime up in Green Bay, apparently, that Mr. Avery's been in prison for 10 years. And the word came down from on high saying, nope, ignore that. That's nonsense. We got our guy. And frankly, you know, if you're a deputy and you've had some guy in prison for 10 years and you don't know much about it, and you hear somebody say something like that, we don't assume that the guys in prison 10 years wrongfully, you know, that hold the phone, the deputy's going to, not knowing anything about it, not think too much of it in terms of doing his own investigation. He's going to send it up the chain of command, and then it comes back from the sheriff. So Link and Colburn, who I know, by the way, who are decent guys, who are the last guys you would think of in terms of, and I'm not so naive to think there aren't some bad cops in this world, but these guys are, I mean, one gives, well, whatever, it's not relevant what he does, but I mean, they are really decent people, and they've
Michael,
been dragged through the mud.
Michael, let me ask you, as the prosecuting attorney out there, there's stories that keep circulating regarding a juror who now says that they were kind of pushed in a direction. What do you make of that claim, and is that a false claim? Is it being blown out of proportion by media outlets? What do you know about that?
I know about it, and Dave, you know, that's one of the good things that can come from this documentary. It's not enough, I don't think, to get a new trial. I mean, that's a tough thing to get a new trial, and it should be, because we can't upset jury verdicts, you know, based upon, unless something is so, you know, outlandish that it removes the confidence in the jury's verdict. That's the legal grounds for it. But let me tell you, you know, I think there ought to be another instruction by the court. When the court instructs a jury before they go for deliberations, they tell them, you know, don't be swayed by sympathy, prejudice, passion, etc. I think they ought to add one, because I think my best information from what I gathered from the documentary and elsewhere and the motion hearing that's already been had is that there were a few jurors who didn't want to listen to the evidence and who were overly aggressive on trying to convince the rest of the jury, come on, don't even look at the evidence, this guy's guilty. That's not what you want in a jury system. And this jury, by the way, did chew on this. I mean, they thought about it for 3 days before they convicted him. They gave Mr. Avery a good chance. They listened to his defense. They pondered it. But as Dan said, in the end, they found, and they're the ones that matter, they found beyond any reasonable doubt that Avery did it. But that's not to say that it's a good thing or that we shouldn't try to prevent jurors from being too pushy and being too aggressive. Everybody on that jury, the sanctity of the jury, everyone needs to have a fair shake at expressing their opinion and not feel intimidated by those who, frankly, might not even have listened to the judge's remarks or instructions that they can't include Dassey's confession, because the jurors, you know, and we all know right. how that works. But so
let me ask Dan then, as we're wrapping up, Dan, just a few minutes left here. What do you believe is the smoking gun in this case? What do you believe that proves without a shadow of a doubt Stephen Avery is guilty of the murder of Teresa Halbeck?
I don't believe there is a single smoking gun, but the totality of the evidence that is sort of glossed over in making a murderer or presumed to have been planted, combined with the evidence that is in fact omitted. And I'm not sure if in the first hour Michael talked about the fact that Avery himself specifically requested that the girl who came there before would
right.
be the one that came on October 31st of 2005. The totality of that, and I believe combined with Dassey's confession that corroborates a lot of that physical evidence, is in fact the sum total of the evidence that shows that he did this. If there was one thing that very closely resembles a smoking gun, almost literally a smoking gun, it would be that bullet fragment. A tiny little bullet fragment, yes, that was found in a subsequent search following the warrant after the Dassey confession in March that did have the victim's DNA on it, that was proven to have been fired from Avery's gun, a gun he kept above his bed, which means he would have noticed if that gun was gone. You take all of this evidence and look at that evidence critically, and it points very clearly, I believe, to the guilt of two men, Stephen Avery and Brendan Dassey.
Michael, do you believe that people have a right to be upset and bothered by this, the evidence that the documentary shows? And should we, with what was gone, what happened, and some of the inconsistencies with the law and the people involved in the investigations, does this open up a dialogue that now we're going to put in new rules so that this type of mistake doesn't happen again, so we don't put ourselves in these positions to be looked at so you know, so deeply and with uncertainty on our actions to try to, you know, solve a crime?
Right. I think the damage that documentary's done to the truth, even though they say truth is elusive in the Stephen Avery case, that's what they say, they claim, and it is in many ways, but they just took their own truth and shoved it down all those people's throats. That damage from that, in terms of the truth in this case, trumped the good that could have come of this, and there still is some good. I agree. I mean, we can differ about the techniques of interrogation. I don't like them, but I'm just one person, and we'll see what the court, and a lot of people were legitimately, I think, Dan, despite, you know, whether it's legally coercive or not, and that remains to be
sure.
seen. A lot of people were legitimately troubled by those techniques on this kid. And there are some other issues, I think, that absolutely are great that they're being discussed. I mean, we have people who usually wouldn't really think through that much some of these thorny criminal justice issues talking about it, you know, all over the country. And that's why I wrote the book, too. This case is so amazing in terms of how it happened, but it also holds within it these lessons for the criminal justice system. And the biggest one to me, and Dave, we started out this show this way, is that this horrible injustice in 1985 inflicted, perpetrated first by the real assailant upon Penny Burnson, not Stephen Avery, but made worse, perpetrated upon Stephen Avery by the authorities, that injustice by the wrongful conviction, knowing wrongful conviction, not an accidental one, festered now for 30 years, and it's still killing us here in Manitowoc County, where half the country thinks, you know, we're more like southern Alabama than...
Right. Well, thank you, Michael. We're out of time. Michael Griesbach, The Innocent Killer, and Dan O'Donnell. You can check out the links on our website for links to his podcasts here on Coast to Coast AM.